KBOO.FM/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sherry Meredith.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're speaking with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about Portland's proposed anti-AI rental price-fixing ordinance.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest story for the paper. It's called City Hall Real Estate Investors Fight Over Portland Anti-Price Fixing Ordinance. Renters have more power at City Hall under Portland's new government structure, rankling real estate developers and lobbyists. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. To get us started, let's talk about the Portland ordinance at the center of the hullabaloo. The anti-rent fixing ordinance that was introduced by Councillor Angelita Murillo. What does this ordinance do? What's it all about?
This ordinance is trying to address a scenario that is happening all over the United States where landlords are indirectly coordinating their rent prices through the use of algorithmic software. You know, proponents of this ordinance say that it essentially allows landlords to skirt antitrust laws that have existed since the late 1800s, as the use of this software and artificial intelligence allows real estate investors to basically outsource all of the, you know, competition that is inherent in, you know, trade in the U.S. To this software through the use of AI.
And this is being brought up in the context of the federal lawsuit against a company called RealPage, which allegedly does all of this type of price fixing all across the country. What can you tell me about RealPage and their business model?
RealPage isn't the only company, but it's certainly the preeminent software company that does this kind of work. So they take private data from landlords who are, you know, participants in this software, and the landlords upload all this information. It goes into their whole algorithm at RealPage, and RealPage is able to then spit out these recommendations back to landlords. That allows the landlords to raise the prices essentially in unison, the same way that it would be if, you know, in the past before algorithms and stuff, if they were just to be meeting and saying, hey, how much are you charging for rent, you know, down on, you know, Cesar Chavez Boulevard or whatever. And that is illegal and has been illegal forever. So the issue here is not that they're using information generally, but that they're using other, like, sensitive information that should be private in order to coordinate prices. And while the landlord isn't saying to another landlord directly, I'm paying this, I'm charging this much and you should charge this much, the software is doing that for them, and it is increasing rents.
Why do advocates, and of course the counselors who've brought this forward, why do they want to pass this? What would be the benefit?
Well, 47% of Portlanders are renters, and so Councillor Murillo, who you mentioned, introduced this bill, said, with that in mind, you know, they deserve to have some representation on the city council and have their needs centered in this. Also, the homelessness crisis is going to continue, and this hopes to help address some of the inflated rents that people face. There was a White House report published in December 2024 that is now gone, from the website, but it said anti-competitive pricing costs renters an average of $70 more per month in the United States in the buildings that use that software. It's as high as $181 in Atlanta. And it said in 2023 overall, renters paid an additional $3.8 billion in additional rent due to the software. So it's worth also noting that that analysis said it also affects rental rates in buildings that don't use the software, because those inflated rents then turn into publicly available information and things like Zillow or whatever that aren't using the same kinds of algorithms. But that information ends up influencing the way that landlords who don't use the software decide to price their buildings.
Well, this has generated a lot of pushback from lobbyists. Who are they, and what has this pushback looked like?
The pushback has come from a lot of organizations that are well recognized in Portland, you know, as groups who have enjoyed very easy access to city officials in the past. The new form of government is really changing the ways that people in the community are able to interact with their government. And the lobbyists from, you know, places like, first of all, RealPage, or the Portland Metro Chamber, Multifamily Northwest, which represents property managers for like 200,000 local units, and then Portland Metro Association of Realtors is a trade organization representing 7,500 members, mostly realtors. You know, these lobbyists appear to be very frustrated. I talked to multiple city councilors who said that a lot of people came in, a lot of lobbyists. There were a lot of urgent emails. There were some kind of fiery exchanges with city councilors, kind of threatening to leave offices, or, you know, during public testimony, you can see people from, you know, investor, you know, with Ritz-Carlton, for instance, you know, kind of pretty frustrated with the idea that the city council would be able to pass something that is not exactly in their favor. All of them will say that they don't condone price fixing. Antitrust laws are, you know, serious, and of course, no one is going to co-sign that. But it does say something that so many people who have enjoyed power for so long at City Hall are extremely frustrated by efforts to protect the renters.
So from these lobbyists, from these groups that you mentioned, what are some of their main concerns about this rent fixing ordinance?
Most of these arguments align very closely with the way that RealPage tries to defend itself in legal actions. Many of the lobbyists say that this could ensnare small landlords who own just a few units, and maybe use like spreadsheets to track rents. One of the RealPage arguments said that a recent ban that's very similar in Berkeley, California, would outlaw the use of math. And kind of the argument here is attempting to say that small landlords will be caught up in this simply for doing business as they normally would. That's not exactly the way that this ordinance is written. It seems pretty clear to me. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a reporter. But this is the kind of thing that's trying to create significant laws that protect renters and from massive corporations. Great Star here in Portland is one of the biggest, I guess they call themselves housing providers in the city. And they, you know, they use RealPage and profit off of being able to raise the rents, you know, as high as they'd like to.
With those concerns, particularly when invoking small mom and pop landlords, is there reason to believe that the concerns are well-founded?
Well, if you're talking about RealPage in particular, that specific program has a 30-unit multifamily unit minimum before a landlord is able to use the pricing software. So it's a little bit of a misnomer that small landlords are even getting into, you know, at least some of these larger, kind of more expensive programs that do this work for them. The thing that is very clear here is that price fixing is illegal, but using math, using spreadsheets, having a spreadsheet for yourself that has multiple units included in a spreadsheet doesn't allow a person, you can't exactly collude with yourself. And so it needs to be across multiple landlords, and it would be across multiple properties. There were some amendments that were proposed that passed that actually created a tiered structure for smaller landlords if they were caught, you know, colluding with their neighbors. Again, price fixing is illegal, whether that is on the golf course as it has been forever, or whether it's online through the use of algorithms. But the idea that small landlords are getting caught up in something simply by Googling what their neighbor's house looks like is going for, you know, is a little bit of a misnomer.
Well, you spoke with someone from the Open Markets Institute about what may be at the heart of this. What was their argument? What did they have to say?
Yeah, I spoke with Brian Kalachi. He's the chief economist at the Open Markets Institute. And he said that the price fixing software really flies in the face of the conventional wisdom, which he called heads in beds. It's where landlords, you have a vacancy, you want to fill that vacancy and then get someone to pay the rent for it. You're better off just filling as many of those as you can. But he said the software changes that, and it instead convinces landlords that they should hold some units back and then raise the rents, because it flies in the face of a typical supply and demand market. So it actually kind of changes the way that developers are even looking to invest. This is an argument that a lot of these associations, these business interests are saying, is that developers are no longer going to come here. I guess the argument is they won't want to come here if they can't use antitrust price fixing software. But Kalachi told me that really, when there's no collusion, rising rents tell developers that there's a scarcity there. And then so as more and more people are bidding for those apartments, rents will then go up, and then that's a signal to developers, hey, let's go there. There's a scarcity. We need to build. And so if there's kind of this excess capacity and open units, but the software is saying that units are full because it has artificially changed those occupancy rates and rents, it's actually going to do the exact opposite.
You've touched on this a little bit, but you spoke with Portland City Councilor Tiffany Koyama-Lane too, and from her estimation, the backlash from industry groups really might not be about the price fixing ordinance itself, which, as you've mentioned, is already illegal on a federal level, but that kind of redundancy isn't illegal in and of itself.
Right. For Koyama-Lane, she was saying, you know, really, like, it seems like a big power shift is occurring at City Hall. And these are people who are used to having access to every elected official in City Hall in a way that is just kind of changing right now. And there's a different representation for Portlanders. I think we'll probably continue with a brand new form of government that has been here for, you know, 4 months now in Portland. But I think that we'll continue to see examples of how exactly the new government structure allows community members to have access to their government in ways that they have been denied in the past. And that's something that is really going to change for, particularly for, you know, renters, low-income people all across the city who generally can't take the middle of the day off to go lobby their public officials.
What are the key takeaways that you hope folks get from this story?
Well, this is the first ordinance that is, you know, legislative, like major piece of legislation that's coming through the process. So there have been a lot of arguments about whether or not the process is being followed here and there. There are some things for the new city council to button up because they were left with a lot of gaps in how the government structure operates. However, one of the main takeaways here, I think, is that lobbyists and business interests are going to do everything that they can to try to scare the public into believing that the whole new form of government is not operating in their interest. But at the same time, these are things that are developed out of the people that move through the government in a way that is representative of what the people need. We are in an affordable housing crisis. Housing affordability is through the roof. People complain about homelessness on the streets. And this is one of those things that's attempting to address those prices that lead people to, you know, having no other option but to sleep outdoors or double up with friends. And that's something that's going to directly impact the livability here in our city. And at the same time, price fixing is and has always been illegal.
If our listeners are interested, where can they find this piece for themselves?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. I want to shout out Etta O'Donnell King, Street Roots illustrator, for doing a fantastic job on this cover. It's worth buying it in print. You can also find us at streetroots.org.
Well, thank you so much, Jeremiah, for coming on to talk with us today.
Thanks, Althea.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest story. It's called City Hall Real Estate Investors Fight Over Portland Anti-Price Fixing Ordinance. Renters have more power at City Hall under Portland's new government structure, rankling real estate developers and lobbyists. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. Coming up this week, Portland Panorama Film Festival starts April 10th through April 20th. I spoke to the event directors to learn more. Would you guys mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, I'm Stephanie Huff. I'm the executive director of Portland Panorama.
And I'm Alina Kiyomi-Kumas. I'm the director of programming at Portland Panorama.
And how did the Portland Panorama come about?
I decided to kind of start this journey about a year and a half ago. I used to work for the Northwest Film Center, and we used to produce the Portland International and Film Festival and the Northwest Filmmakers Fest. And both of those events went away when the Film Center kind of changed hands and during the pandemic. So there's just been a hole in the community where a large international film festival used to sit. So I thought it was time to bring something back to town.
Since you've worked at so many other film festivals, what makes Portland Panorama unique?
I worked at a few festivals at this point for over 5 years. But, you know, Portland Panorama is just really unique in that it is such a central, tight group of people who all have different skills in the industry and have, you know, just so much diverse knowledge in different parts of the industry. So it's just been great to see everyone come together. And, you know, it's just really exciting to see the community so excited for this event as well. Like, we've had nothing but positive feedback and, you know, just the general excitement from the community has been beautiful, I would say. Portland Panorama is unique for a festival in Oregon anyway, because it integrates both national and international films and content, as well as making space for a sort of Northwest Filmmaker Showcase. So the first half of the festival is going to be at Cinema 21, and that will showcase national, international titles, both features and short films. The second half of the festival is geared towards Northwest filmmakers, so it kind of serves essentially as a Northwest Filmmaker Showcase. And, you know, we really wanted to bring these two types of films and region-specific focuses together so it can expose not only the local Northwest community to all of these international bigger titles that wouldn't necessarily come through Portland, and vice versa. You know, I'm bringing in people into Portland who, you know, perhaps have never been to Portland before, and exposing them to the Northwest talent that we have here as well.
Yeah, I would say also what, you know, kind of makes Portland Panorama unique is some of our programming. So in addition to Melina's amazing programming, we also partnered with local organizations to kind of support those different programs. So for instance, we're doing a screening of Pretty Ugly, the Story of the Luna Chicks with the Oregon Media Lab and Doc Camp on Friday the 11th at Cinema 21. And then we're also doing a screening of Sanctuary Station with Cinema Project during the festival, and that's also at Cinema 21.
That being said, too, we also have a few screenings kind of scattered around the city as well. So while our main venues are Cinema 21 and the Hollywood Theater, we also have screenings at the Kennedy School in Northeast Portland. There's going to be a screening at the Boathouse Micro Cinema, which is really exciting. It kind of art and experimental film space. We're going to have a screening at the Judy downtown as well. Also a special Northwest music video showcase at PNC Live Lounge downtown as well.
Why did you guys choose to showcase music videos?
Yeah, that was, we used to do a showcase very similar to this as part of the Northwest Film Center. And as someone who's worked in both film and music, it was always kind of like a nice combination for me. I love music videos. I think there's not a lot of exhibition opportunities for them, and a lot of festivals choose not to include music videos, but we love music, so we wanted to include that. And then we've got some great live performances as well. So the PNC Live Studio is a recording space where they do live performances year-round. And so we've got Jessica Boudreaux from Summer Cannibals and Cloud Stokely, who are going to do live performances there that night too.
So the festival shifts midweek to celebrate the filmmakers. What does that mean?
The whole festival is a celebration of filmmakers and films that we usually wouldn't get to see in Portland, but I think you're referring to the Hollywood Theater portion of the festival, which is a Northwest Filmmaker Showcase. This is all films made by local Northwest creators and or films shot in the region. So this showcase essentially is just to really offer a platform for our local creators to see their works on the big screen, as well as to invite the community to participate in, you know, post-screening Q&A discussions, and just to be able to see all of the amazing film productions that are being made currently in Portland and the Northwest regional area.
Do you guys have any movies or panels you're excited to see?
I mean, I'm biased. I'm excited for everything personally. But yeah, you know, I guess one thing I'll say is we do have a lot of filmmakers attending this festival. We even have a filmmaker attending from Iceland for her short film. It's called Mamu. It's in one of the international shorts programs. I think it's International Shorts Program 1. But, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers attending. I am really excited for, I guess, specifically for me, it would be international and national films that have not had any play in Portland. So, for instance, we have the Oregon premiere of Standing Above the Clouds, which is a really beautiful Native Hawaiian documentary that just hasn't had play here. There's just so many events, panels, workshops, parties, you know, everything like that. So there's something for everyone, I would say. And yeah, there's just like a lot of opportunities to connect and bring the community together. And yes, I'm particularly excited, I would say, for some of our international titles that just probably wouldn't come through Portland. Like, I would say maybe The Ugly Stepsister, which is one of our late night screenings. That one's a really fun one, so I highly recommend that one. Also part of our kind of late night programming, we have a late night shorts program. It is in our Northwest portion of the festival because 6 out of 8 of the films are made by Northwest creators. And that actually goes for a few of our international shorts programs. A lot of them have films made by local filmmakers in the mix as well. So there's just a lot of things to check out, lots of shorts programs, lots of features, lots of events and panels in general. So yeah.
Yeah. I'm really excited, like Melina, for most everything. I mean, for everything in our festival. We had to make a lot of hard decisions in programming to say no to some really amazing films. So everything in here was chosen for a reason. And I would say I'm really excited for Firebreak, the documentary by Kenzie Bruce. She's a local filmmaker and who works with Blue Chalk Media. It's about formerly incarcerated firefighters formerly incarcerated folks who become firefighters and do that work. I'm really excited for Firebreak. We have Kenzie Bruce, who's going to be there at the Hollywood, as well as some of the subjects from the film. I'm also really excited for a screening of A Midsummer Night's Dream in Prison, which is a short doc. Well, it's a feature doc, but it's an hour long documentary by the late Bushra Azus, who was my mentor in film school and also was a teacher at the Film Center for many years. It's her last film that she made about inmates performing Shakespeare in prison. So it's a very moving documentary, really important message. And some of the filmmaking team will be there with some of the subjects of the film as well.
If people want to find out more about attending these events, where can they get more information?
Yeah, so our full program lineup is available at portlandpanorama.org. You can find individual tickets to events and screenings, or you can purchase passes there as well, where you can get, you know, everything in the festival, or just the movies, or just the Northwest movies. So,
is there anything we didn't cover that you would like to mention?
I'm really excited about an event that we have during the festival. It's called Safety Day Saturday. It takes place over at Wonder Love over in Southeast. It was funded in part by the Central East Side Better Together grant. So we're really excited, and with RAC. It's a partial day event. We're going to have vendors. We'll have Gearhead and Via Films there to do a demonstration on like picture and camera cars and safety around that. And then we'll have two panels on production protocol safety and then interpersonal wellness. So we're really excited for that event and to get folks out. It's a great networking opportunity. It's a great education opportunity as well. So I'm really excited for that. And that all precedes a screening at the Hollywood at 2:30 of a new documentary called Safe Sets that kind of touches on some of the more intense safety issues and some of the fatalities that have happened more recently in film productions, but also talks about a wide range of safety hazards in our industry, including like special effects and makeup and, you know, people that are doing stop motion animation and working with different chemicals and things. So it's gonna be a really interesting day, and I'm really passionate about keeping our workers and creatives in our industry safe. So it's gonna be a good opportunity to learn more.
And tomorrow is our big opening night. Our opening night film is Pony Boy, and after that, we're going to have a big opening night party at the Hoxton, and there's still a few tickets left, I think, for that. So, yeah, I guess grab your tickets while you can.
Yep.
But yeah, in general, you know, there's, I mean, I would say all the programming this season was very intentional, and, you know, it was really hard to make these tough decisions. There were just so many films that were submitted and just so many options in terms of programming. So, you know, every single program that we have, there's been thought and intention put into it. And so I really hope people can check out the schedule and the whole programming and come out to Portland Panorama.
Well, thank you guys for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. The festival kicks off April 10th. More information is available at portlandpanorama.org. That was Stephanie Huff and Melina Kiyomi Kumas from Portland Panorama Film Festival. This is Lexis Ponce with KBOO News.
With recent changes in immigration laws and deportation policies, threats to trans and queer gender-affirming care, as well as simple recognition, the lessening of reproductive rights, defunding of climate protections, and an onslaught of daily atrocities in national and international politics. Many Americans are feeling called to organize community and create connections to help keep one another safe on a local level. In Portland, many have found a home at the Workers' Tap, a local cafe and bar that opened in spring of 2022.
It was really born out of activist and union organizing.
That is Connor, one of the original founders and a current co-owner of the Workers' Tap. Four friends and members of Portland DSA founded the bar to provide a third space to meet and organize with friends, coworkers, and community members in a time when those places are especially needed.
I joined DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, in 2016 after the November election. And then like DSA was exploding in growth throughout like 2016, 17, 18. And you know, I think there was a certain point where it was like, hey, there are like two meetings, Portland DSA meetings a week, and we can't figure out where to put them. And so that was really what motivated me to find a space, because I knew just DSA alone plus other organizations, we could, you know, pack the place.
The Tap found its home in a 1904 Victorian house on the corner of Ankeny and 12th. The upstairs bedrooms have been repurposed into meeting rooms, and there is even a small library on the second floor. Unions and community members can rent the upstairs meeting rooms for free, and sometimes the basement floor opens up for special events. The Tap has also started a strike fund for workers and unions bargaining for a better working conditions.
We just recently started a strike fund for local unions, particularly ones that don't have like big union ties yet, because those ones already have access to funds. First Saturday of the month, we have a 10% of our sales for the day go to the strike fund. And then when a union goes on strike in Portland, we are able to just donate money right away.
The Workers' Tap originally opened as a beer bar, but has recently made the transition to being a cafe as well. They adjusted their hours to 9 a.m. to midnight daily in hopes to make the space more accessible to all throughout the day.
I've had kind of this larger scheme, so to speak, a program that I wanted to put on. It's kind of in two pieces, right? I think that one of the bigger things that I wanted to do was kind of go above and beyond what people consider like ethical trade practices with coffee, especially on my sourcing.
The coffee program was a recent addition to the TAP. They hired on Gil, or Gilberto Dominguez, early in 2024. He's a coffee specialist and has been in the industry for 10 years.
A lot of the coffee producers that I work with and who roast our beans are people who have direct connections. Either they're members of the agricultural cooperatives from the coffee farms, or their families are the people who own and work at the farms in the countries that they're from. So my hope is we can start showcasing more people who have direct connections to the people who are doing that work, and kind of eliminating the need to necessarily place a label like fair trade or something, because it's like we're doing the most we can. The second part of what I want to see is there's a talk all around town about like revitalizing third spaces. We are a place that is very, very out and loud. You know, we say it with our chest. We're a community space. We're very transparent about what we stand for and what we believe in. And we invite people who share those values to come into the space freely. And I think that we're in a unique position where it's kind of like the bar is able to support itself, right? The coffee program and the space is able to be open and utilized by people. And I kind of want to just like ramp that up, right? Make this a place where people can come and be comfortable and hang out and sit for as long as they like, as well as being an important space for organizing.
The Workers' Tap is open from 9 a.m. to midnight every day. To visit them in person, you can go to their location at 12th and Ankeny in Southeast Portland, or you can email them online at workerstap@gmail.com. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Hannah Francis.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO, Portland. No compromise in defense of the truth.